This is the current federal tax developments for the week of July the 13th, 2020. Current federal tax developments are brought to you by your State Society of CPAs and Kaplan Financial Education. This week we're going to look at a few things that have been happening. We've got some developments here. Now Congress is coming back to town now, I should say. So we might see something happening before the August recess, but we have to keep our eye on it, see what's going to go on. But we haven't had anything big recently, so we'll talk about what we did have. We'll talk about certain clarifications the IRS gave this week about reporting W-2 wages that were, or wages paid on a W-2 that came from the FFCRA, various paid leave credit programs, and we do that because of self-employed, so we'll have a little discussion there. We'll talk to you about the final signing of the extension of the PPP loan program through August 8th, how that works and what's there. We also have a IRS updates and FAQ to talk about the CARES Act provider relief payments. Some of you may work with medical professionals who receive those payments. We'll discuss briefly how they're taxed. We also have the new 280 cap F depreciation limits for autos that are placed in service in 2020 have been released by the IRS. The IRS took a look at, in the memorandum, whether Section 265A1, our favorite section from not getting to deduct expenses that are paid for by PPP forgiven loans, does that section also impact a charity that has unrelated business income, and does that bar some or all of the deductions from being claimed for UBIT purposes? And we'll come to the IRS conclusion there, which, not to keep you in suspense, is no, it doesn't, but we'll talk about why it doesn't. And finally, we want to point out, too, the IRS released this week a flowchart that explains the new Bipartisan Budget Act partnership audit regime, how it works, and what we have to do working with it. Well, I figure some of you probably aren't listening to this till later in the week because, hey, rumor mill has it, this is the April 15th that got moved by 3 months is coming up on Wednesday. So if it's a 16th or so, then, yeah, you know, this came out earlier. And I figure a lot of you probably aren't going to spend a lot of time, and I suspect a few of you will be listening to it next week, because the last thing you're going to want to do on the 16th is listen to a bunch of tax discussions, but we'll talk a little bit about what's coming up here. So let's go ahead and let's start with our first issue, and this is Notice 2020-54. And this deals with something the IRS realized is going to be needed by certain people preparing the returns. What is Notice 2020-54 issued on July the 8th talks about is guidance about employers reporting on Form W-2 to the employees information regarding the amount of their wages that were paid under the Families First Coronavirus Relief Act, basically sick pay or family leave pay credit programs. Now, why is that needed? Well, the main reason it's needed is because if that employee is also self-employed, self-employed can qualify for a reduction, a refundable reduction of self-employment tax that is based on the same payment for leave concept, but they can't pick that up and pick up the same thing for their employment time. So they need to know, did they have any of these paid for by the tax credit wages on their jobs? And so that's what we're going to have to report on our Form W-2s. Now, basically, we're going to report this on Form W-2, and we're going to report this in, and it'll be either the qualified sick leave wages or the qualified family leave wages. And it'll be reported, in this case, on the form in Box 14 of the Form W-2 or in a separate statement. We're to report the total amount of qualified sick leave wages paid for any of the, you know, major reasons, you know, the first three reasons, the 100% wages, plus also the last three reasons you might get sick pay wages. And you're going to report any of in that second category, how much were in the first, how much were in the second. The other thing you're going to end up doing is you're going to do the same reporting if somebody got qualified family medical leave, paid medical leave under this. Remember, that was the additional period on top of the first 2 weeks that you got if you were taking care of a child because the school was closed, etc. So that was kind of the issue. Now, the W-2 itself, obviously, we're putting this in Box 14, which is kind of miscellaneous disclosure. The IRS provides model language in this notice to help explain this to the employees, because obviously HR departments are going to get a lot of discussion about this, and people are going to want to know, what do I do with this? What does this mean? Why do I care? So we're going to give them language to go with that. They suggest that. I suspect most forms and most companies will just use the model language, because why try to write your own and just kind of go from there? But that does mean this year, the W-2, you're going to have to track these wages that have been paid, for which you got the credit for either sick time or the credit for paid family medical leave, or both. And you're going to have to report that on the W-2s for this year. Next up, Senate Bill 4116, that was signed into law on the 4th of July. And what this did was, it was looking at the fact that the PPP loan program was going to expire on June the 30th, 2020. Now, as you may recall, that was kind of a big fight when we had the extension. You know, we modified the PPP loan program. They had to give assurances to Senator Johnson of Wisconsin that, in fact, they wouldn't be making loans after June 30. And they gave him that assurance. They indicated that there was an authorization for expenditures after that date, so everything was fine. So Senator Johnson apparently thought it was fine. He, at that time, did not want to vote to extend this. Now, his argument would probably be, at this point, didn't want to extend it until December. But for whatever reason, on the day before the Senate was to leave for the 4th of July recess, they passed this by unanimous consent. And it actually came up and was passed right in that final afternoon. It was kind of, you know, most people thought it wasn't going anywhere. This is actually Senator Cardin, who's the ranking Democrat on the Small Business Committee in the Senate. But apparently Senator Rubio, who is the chair, indicated he wasn't opposed to the concept. All it does, and this is what's important to remember, is it just allows people who didn't get a PPP loan, because you're not allowed to get two of them, it allows businesses that did not get a PPP loan, had not applied for one, right, hadn't gotten one before, to go ahead and apply. This is for that $100 billion or so that's still left over. Now, it is extended only to August the 8th, and the reason why is that's the date Congress leaves for the August recess. What this really is meant to do is show Congress is doing something before they turn out the next coronavirus relief bill. Whatever you want to call this bill, if we call it economic relief or we call it stimulus or whatever title you want to give the bill, we get an argument as to whether we can have stimulus. You know, is this stimulus or is this just straight out economic relief? Six of one, half dozen of the other in some ways, though economists get really worked up on that concept. But we do expect there will be some bill. Obviously, the House passed their bill, and they passed a bill that I think they were pretty sure the Senate wasn't going to go along with. The Senate will probably pass a bill in the same way that they know the House won't go along with. And then we'll have somebody negotiate the real bill. Apparently, we're still in that mode of waiting for the House to negotiate, waiting for the Senate to come up with their bill, and then go in and try to hammer out some sort of deal they'll both pass, probably on August the 8th, because these things tend to take that long to go. Probably, I mean, to be honest, if it, you know, a lot of it depends upon how this whole coronavirus situation works out over the next few weeks. You know, if it appears that we are having, you know, major economic problems based on the increasing number of cases, hospitalizations, etc. And of course, I'm sitting here in Phoenix, which at this point in time is in the middle of, you know, it's kind of like the leading edge of the, you know, group two, shall we call them, states that are getting hit by the wave. You know, we had it happen in the Northeast mainly at the first wave. We had it very heavy there. Now we're seeing it come here. Obviously, we're still in the process of seeing what actually is going to happen here, you know, how it all plays out. But if it does get bad and other states keep adding to it, that might make Congress quicker on coming up with something. If it were to plateau out and not much more was to happen and it didn't get much worse and, you know, hospitalizations don't really fill everything up and we don't really get the deaths coming way higher, you know, they stay down and they don't start looking like what we had back when it was ravaging New York, New Jersey, etc., then it may take longer and it may be a less ambitious bill. But whatever it is, we do expect to see something this month. And this was a pretty good sign that they're now serious on working on something, because otherwise, why worry about extending this to August 8th? You know, if we're just going to let it die, let it die. So we'll see what happens. Next up, the IRS issued decided they needed another set of frequently asked questions. And this deals with the provider relief payments that were added as part of the CARES Act. The CARES Act added these things called provider relief payments. And then we're talking about here healthcare provider relief payments, right? And they were supposed to reimburse healthcare providers for healthcare-related expenses or lost revenues attributable to the COVID-19 pandemic. And so it came into the various, you know, physicians' accounts, right? We got all of these things coming. Now the question becomes, what's the tax impact of that? As you might guess, with everything going on and some things non-taxable, you know, and we have all these other questions, you know, is there some special treatment for this? Reality is the answer is pretty much no. This is going to be considered income, right? It's going to be considered income or a direct reduction of expenses. Now, some people had said, wait, we've got this section 139. We've talked about that section before. And that's the section that talks about excluding from income payments to individuals that are meant to be relief for various things related to natural disasters. And remember, the COVID-19 emergency effectively created the disaster designation that allows us, you know, to use 139. And the question becomes, well, can't these, because this is being paid, we're told for sure, these are expenses, right, and lost revenue due to COVID-19, due to the disaster. Well, can't we exclude those under 139? And the IRS says actually no. A couple of reasons why. The main reason why is because 139 only applies to individuals. And more specifically, the IRS says it doesn't apply to a business. So even if the doctor is a sole proprietorship, they cannot use 139. This is not what 139 was meant for, right? 139 does not cover everything. 139 is very specific, paid to individuals for specific individual items that, you know, they're going to incur because of a disaster. This doesn't qualify for that, so I say, sorry, don't try that. The second question, it's a really short FAQ. It's only got two questions. There was a discussion, what if you are a, you know, tax-exempt healthcare provider, right? If you're exempt from federal taxation, you know, is this taxable? And they say, generally, no. You know, if you're described in 501c, right, of the code, as exempt from federal income taxation under 501a, and they said, don't, you know, now, if, however, your health provider operations for your organization represents unrelated business income, which it could, if that was the structure you had, you were not a tax exempt for healthcare, and you had just had this operating business, then they said, yeah, it would still be taxable for UBIT, but it's got to be related to the UBIT directly. You know, generally, if you're an exempt healthcare provider organization or 501, basically they're under the rules there that we have under section 501, then you don't pay tax on that income that comes from the healthcare services you're providing. So yeah, wouldn't really be part of it. Next up, Revenue Procedure 2020-37 issued on July 8th. This is the annual limitation on Section 280F for depreciation on vehicles, what many of you, you know, referred to very quickly as the, you know, the luxury auto rules was the term. And actually, the limits haven't really gone up that much over the years, and it wasn't much of a luxury auto when it first came in anyway. But, you know, we still call it the luxury auto rules. And they did put them out for 2020, so these are the 2020 numbers. If you get bonus on the vehicle, the first year limit is $18,100, second year depreciation $16,100, third year $9,700, fifth year, you know, or fourth year and succeeding $5,760. If you do not claim bonus, right, you either aren't eligible to claim bonus or you just elect not to, then you're capped at $10,100, $8,000 less. And all following years are still the same cap as under the other method. So everything else stays the same. So if you did have anybody, you know, who's acquired a car in 2020, you know, and you wondered what the limits were, we now have those limits. They're out there. We're ready to go with them. Should work just fine. Next up, we have a chief counsel advice, 2020-27-003. And this takes a look at that code section we've talked about before, section 265A1. We talked about that very long and hard when we were looking at the Paycheck Protection Program loan proceeds. When they're excluded from income, does that also mean you don't get a deduction for the expense? And according to the IRS, the answer is, yeah, you don't get a deduction for the expense because it related to tax-exempt income. You cannot claim a deduction for an expense that relates to tax-exempt income. You know, and you might, you know, that was like, we used to think about that primarily in the concept of, like, if you had, borrowed money to buy municipal bonds, which seems more a little crazy, but let's say you had, that interest would not be deductible. If you had advisory fees that you paid specifically for, you know, investing in tax-exempt bonds, then, yeah, you wouldn't have been able to deduct those back when we could deduct investment advisory fees, right? Expenses related to exempt income. Well, somebody in the IRS started looking at this, and maybe because of the Paycheck Protection Program loan ruling, said, hey, wait a minute. You know, what about a charity? You know, charities are tax exempt, right? But if it has an unrelated business, it pays unrelated business income tax. Now, it has a whole bunch of expenses that it gets to do that go against the income from the unrelated income, the unrelated business. And the question we're going to ask is, well, you know, in essence, because the charity has all of this exempt income, and clearly, you know, they can write, money's fungible, they could be right, you know, they'll write the checks, and it may literally come directly from those contributions, the theory of at least this person asking the question was that, doesn't that mean that at least that all or a large portion of the expenses are non-deductible? You know, so maybe it's some sort of ratio of the business revenue reduced by, you know, basically in ratio to the exempt revenue. And, you know, the IRS said, well, no. The chief counsel's office says, no. 265A1 only counts if the expense is directly related to the exempt income. In this case, the expenses allowed under UBIT are related to the unrelated business. As that's kind of a weird way of phrasing it, but we'll talk about that way, related to an unrelated business. Well, since it directly ties to the business, you know, it's not tied back to the exempt income. Not being tied to the exempt income, 265A1 would not impact it. So you'd still be able to get your deduction. Why, for the Paycheck Protection Program loans, that doesn't work? It's because you said, I use these funds to pay for these expenses that I'm using to get forgiveness. And so because of that, to the extent they're forgiven, you essentially now have that direct link and the deduction is disallowed. So IRS says, yeah, this is just different. So, you know, don't worry about it. It just works differently. You know, not really our problem. So, okay, we can live with that. Finally, this week, we may finish early this week. This will be good. The IRS issued Publication 5388, the Bipartisan Budget Act Roadmap for Taxpayers, issued on June 30th. It actually was issued about the week of June 30th. It's dated 6/20/2020. And this is very simply just a, you know, what's essentially a flow chart, is a single page. It's a publication, but it's not what you're going to think about traditionally as a publication. It's a single page flow chart that talks about the Bipartisan Budget Act examination process, starting with, you know, the filing of the return, audit selection issues, the notifications. And so what it looks like across the top, it looks at filing, audit selection, the audit process itself and post-audit. And down the side, it looks at, you know, the centralized partnership process for this. It has an issue of time frames involved for various items in here and the notifications a taxpayer will receive. The IRS indicated they discovered that a lot of taxpayers have little or no understanding of the program. And because of that, you know, they said we need to put this out. Now, if you remember, this applies to tax year 2018 and later parts of returns. And, you know, it applies unless you are eligible to opt out and you do opt out. If you're eligible to opt out and you do opt out, right, then, you know, that's the key, opting out. So if you start with this, you can disappear in the upper left corner by doing the opt out. But that has to be on the original return. And it has to be, you know, and so you can't wait to get an exam notice to say, wait, I don't want to be under this program. I want to just go ahead and do it under the free TEFRA, right? The old small partnership programs under TEFRA, which is basically the same rule we have today if you do the opt-out. No, you know, you don't do that. Otherwise, it walks you through the whole process of how you get notified, the central audit process, which is very similar to TEFRA, you know, internally looking at the partnership as a whole, you know, take a look at income, expenses, credits, et cetera, at the partnership level. But then when we get to the end, that's where it's different. At the end of the audit, instead of now getting these amounts that are pushed through, they're automatically picked up on partners' returns, and we have 20,000 assessments. Now the partnership gets an assessment, and now it has choices to make. If you've not spent a lot of time on this, or you just want a good, quick reference to the process, this flow chart's very useful. We do have the link on the website. We also have the link in the PDF if you download that for this week. Also, you can just look for publication 5388, and that will give you this nice little document. Like I said, a lot of people that I've seen, if you're eligible to, most of my clients have been willing and have wanted to go ahead and do the opt-out on the return. Right, just opt out with the return, take it that way, and don't worry about it. There is a temporary option we discussed earlier that for 2018 and 2019 on exams, you're allowed to, or I should say pre-exam, non-exam situations, you are allowed to amend the partnership return. Remember, if you don't opt out of the Bipartisan Budget Act, generally, now we have this little special rule now for 18 and 19 we just got, but generally for 20 and later years, you cannot amend the return. You've got to go through effectively a process very similar to the end of audit process that is outlined in this flow chart to change a partnership return. And the big things that affects are, number one, you either pay the tax at the highest rates, highest individual rates, you know, on the with the partnership return, amended, you know, with the partnership revised, you know, a request for administrative adjustment, the AAR, administrative adjustment request, or you do a push out to your individual partners, which sounds like an amended return, except it doesn't go back and hit the year you're changing. It rather is picked up by the partner. They have to pick it, they could beat the tax that would have happened had they made the change. And then they have to pick that up on their current, their year return for the year that you push the notice out. And then also get interest and penalties through that date and treat it that way. If it is a good news, right, you know, that we over-report income, so there's a reduction, then they compute how much their tax would have gone down in that year. But what they get is a credit, and the real problem comes into that really mess things up is that credit is non-refundable and does not carry forward. So if you happen to do the push out and the taxpayer has a year that they have a big loss, you know, have a net operating loss they create in a year, that adjustment may not give them any tax back, but will still adjust their basis. So, yeah, it's a bit of a mess when you got the PPP program. So that's why it's for the last 2 years, we can fix them now. So 18, 19 returns can be fixed under effectively the old style amendment process, but 20 and later years cannot. But like I said, it's a very useful roadmap if you've not spend a lot of time on this program. You know, you might want to get, if you have spent time, it's just a good summary and reminder of the steps involved. The IRS is kicking this out because they are beginning to actually do these exams. And the IRS states they found that a lot of taxpayers aren't aware of how the program works. So they're going to help you. I want to remind you that coming up a week from the filing date, I'm going to be doing a four-hour monthly tax update for the New Jersey Society of CPAs. NJCPA is going to put this on. It'll be a four-hour tax update It'll be for the last month. So we'll take a look at from the last session we did, which was on June 16th. I'm going to roll from that date forward to July 22nd. We actually give this four-hour session. So if you are a member of NJCPA, you can register on their website. If you're a non-member, you can also register too. You have to pay the non-member fee. But we're going to be doing those sessions. So if you're available and you want to sit on the webcast, everything's being webcast these days, as I think I mentioned last week. Even if they were trying to do a live course, if I went to New Jersey, I couldn't be in the room, right? I would have to quarantine. So I'd have had to have left the beginning of July to have been sitting in New Jersey for 2 weeks before I could actually go see anybody in a room in New Jersey, assuming they were doing it in a room in New Jersey, which they're not. So it will be a webcast, will be available. Go ahead, sign up, and we'll take a look, and hopefully I'll see you guys there. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of July 13th, 2020. Current Federal Tax Developments are brought to you by your State Society of CPAs and by Kaplan Financial Education. You can catch our updates on the web at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. If you have any questions or comments, you can email me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. I do post on Twitter when things happen, so you can follow me there at edzollers. I also participate in state societies, discussion groups for Arizona, Minnesota, New Jersey, Illinois, Washington. I watch those sites and look for them. So if you have questions there, those sites are very useful for posing questions and issues. Some are more active than others. But you can still get some useful information on those. You also might want to take a look at the site at reddit.com/r/taxbros for some discussion. Stay away from /r/taxes unless you just want some entertainment because that's everybody trying to get free tax advice. So tax pros are pretty good at handling that. So we have that available as well. Well, like I said, this is the filing week. So, we expect we're still going to get some more guidance probably from the IRS on a number of things related to the CARES Act. We still have issues that are arisen. Oh, by the way, we did this week, get additional guidance that relates to, some of the foreign tax aspects of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. So we had those things come down this week. We expect we'll see some other things. We know that if you're interested in the 199 Cap A special rules for cooperatives, agricultural cooperatives, that has left the office, that has left basically, the reviews process. It's now going on from left OIRA. It's now going to go on to final release, we assume, at the IRS. So keep your eyes on that. And we'll keep our eyes on what's happening and try to keep you up what's going on. So we'll be back. See you here next week for more current federal tax developments.